This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. The topic of sex and young teens is not an easy one to talk about. For parents and people who work with kids, there's a lot of uncertainty about exactly what to say, how to say it, and when to say it. For kids, talking about sex with parents can be an embarrassing and anxiety-filled conversation. For parents, too. And if embarrassment, complacency, and alarm are not enough, there's also a fair amount of confusion about exactly what young teenagers are doing or not doing when it comes to sex. Sarah Brown wants to change all that. She's director of the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy, and just today her organization released a new report titled 14 and Younger, The Sexual Behavior of Young Adolescents. It may be the most comprehensive report to date on what 12, 13, and 14-year-olds think about sex and what they are actually doing. Sarah Brown hopes the research will encourage more honest discussion between teens and adults and help teens make the best choices for themselves. This hour, we want to hear from callers, of course, especially if you're the parent of a young teenager or someone who works with young teens. What have you talked about with your teen? What haven't you talked about, and why? What are your questions about this new report? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And the email address is totn@npr.org. Sarah Brown is with us here in Studio 3A to talk about the report and take your questions, and we appreciate coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we start, I want to acknowledge, obviously, this is a sensitive subject for a lot of people. Our listeners should know that we could be mentioning specific sexual behaviors. Obviously, our purpose is clarity and not prurience. And that said, why don't we begin with some of the major findings? According to your research, about one in five young teenagers has sexual intercourse before their 15th birthday. Does that surprise you?
Well, you know, we've been floating this number a little bit with friends and colleagues over the last week or two to ask them, does it surprise you? And I've been very interested in the range of responses. Some people say, gee, I thought it was more. I go, really? And some people say, I'm amazed. I had no idea. It's almost like sort of an inkblot test. You know, what do you see in this number? So I think one thing we've learned is that we need more information and more good information about young teens, because clearly there's a lot of just general ignorance. Young people, you know, are doing lots of things, and I think the adults either haven't asked or don't know.
And this is not an insignificant finding. You report something like 20,000 pregnancies and 8,000 births each year for those 14 and younger.
That's right. Those are figures. In the case of pregnancies, it's from 1999. For births, it's 2001. Now, of course, that's a small proportion of total teen births and pregnancies. So we don't want to be alarmist here. It is not these young teens that are driving the very high rates of teen pregnancy and birth in the U.S. But I think what's important is that these young people are at particularly high risk. They're not just sort of like little 19-year-olds. When you start having sex early, 12, 13, you're likely to have many more partners in adolescence and possibly beyond, which, of course, increases your risk of sexually transmitted diseases, AIDS, pregnancy. There's also some evidence that these young people who are sexually active are also engaged in other risky behaviors, alcohol use, tobacco, drugs, even some evidence of juvenile crime issues, probably relatively minor. But these behaviors tend to cluster. Not always, but these young people are at particularly high risk, so they merit deep attention and concern from all of us.
I was also interested in the finding that most of them, a great majority of them, believe they are too young to be having sex, and that this is the moment when they are most receptive to messages about how to control behaviors that could become risky.
Well, parents often don't understand what you just said, Neil. They often think that by the time they're, I don't know, 11 or 12, that they're lost to popular culture in the mall and, you know, just unsupervised time. But public opinion polls, interviews with teens that we've done and many others have shown that teenagers, even these very young ones, or particularly these very young ones, really do want to hear from the parents in their lives. Now, they sometimes don't look like it. You know, they may be kind of looking like they'd rather be anywhere but here when we're going into these things. But it's important to talk to young people. And even if they don't look receptive, they are listening. And parents should not be put off by a vacant stare or, you know, some apparent discomfort. Oh, Mom, please don't. they're still listening, mm-hmm. and they still want to know what you think.
How much do they actually know, and aren't they getting some information? Every public school in the country, I think, has education programs.
Well, there's education. There are a number of very good surveys that try and understand what young people know, and here's sort of the way I think about it. Young people know a number of simple facts, but they often don't know facts in depth. So it's not that you either know or don't know, it's that you begin to understand, and it takes a long time to master all this stuff. There is a lot to understand. AIDS, STDs, risks of pregnancy, different contraceptive devices and the protection they offer, there's a lot. But I think sometimes we focus too much on particular facts about what young people know and forget, particularly if you're parents, that it's what all these facts mean, the context that surrounds them, the values, the popular culture. Those are the issues that challenge teens as much as any particular piece of knowledge. It's interesting. Young adolescents are very good at absorbing and sort of spitting back facts. You know, they can recite baseball statistics. They can give you the details of Dawson's Creek in detail.
Mm-hmm. Even the occasional irregular French verb.
Once in a while. That's right. But the issue of how do I manage myself in a middle school or maybe even in my first year of high school when I think everybody's having sex and I'm not? Now, there's a kind of question that is not fact-based. How do I keep my girlfriend without having sex with her? I'm feeling a lot of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So although we certainly need to talk with young people about facts, there are a lot of them, I think that we should talk as much, if not even more, about what the complexity of their lives are like, what their friends are doing, how they feel about it, the pressures on them. How do you know what to do in difficult situations? Parents don't have to have the answer, but they have to be askable. They have to be willing to engage in those topics with their young people. And you know what? If you don't know a particular fact, we can always look that up. Mm-hmm. That's the easy part.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. And joining us now is Ed, who's on the line from Denver, Colorado.
Oh, hello.
Hi.
I really enjoy your show. I listen about every day.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes, I'm a psychologist in Colorado. I work with kids and adolescents. And my question is, did your survey look at the influence of alcohol on making the decision to have sex?
Well, we do know that amongst young teens, and indeed amongst older ones as well, that alcohol can play a role in sort of unplanned sex as well as unintended sex, and unprotected and so forth. What we don't know is sort of the sequence and how they relate precisely. We know, as a psychologist, you know this phrase, they co-occur. These behaviors cluster.
Right.
But we don't know exactly the order. What teenagers tell us, including young teenagers, is that it is not at all uncommon for there to be an unsupervised party where alcohol is present and possibly marijuana, and things happen. That's the sort of phrase they'll use. And for some, it's, kids hook up, maybe not have sex, maybe do.
Mm-hmm.
So we know these things occur often in the same setting and same time. But we don't understand the precise relationship. I mean, just for example, a lot of federal surveys just talk about drugs and alcohol. They don't separate alcohol from drugs, and they don't often specify which drug. That's just one example of how we need to know more. But I thought it was interesting, for example, that in one of the surveys that we reported, which was just from a small area, it's not nationally representative, about half of 14-year-olds reported that they'd been at a party without any adults in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, and you know, that that is an opportunity, not assurance, but opportunity for there to be alcohol present as well.
Yeah, I've heard about some of those parties firsthand, and I'm amazed at how much alcohol is available, how they get it, how they acquire it, and also at really how alone and unsupervised these parties can be. And I think some parents really are turning a blind eye to problems. And this is in some higher economic status areas. I'm sure it's across the board, too.
Your survey as in general found, I think, that those whose mothers at least had a higher educational, had gone to college to some degree, in general were experiencing less sex than those whose mothers had not.
Yes, there's some relationship between sort of higher socioeconomic status and lower risk, but we don't want to overstate this. The U.S. has the highest rates of teen pregnancy, birth, and abortion in the industrialized world. And we see this phenomenon and a lot of the issues we're discussing today in many, many different areas of the country. And I think we'd be mistaken to ever think, well, it's just them or it's just us or it's just this one group. The issue of the difficulties that young people face in adolescence, including very young adolescence, which is the focus of this report, are powerful and they're of great concern. Now, what's interesting, I find, is that adults and community programs and so forth often think about adolescent risk in different categories. You know, we have Drug Week, or then we have Unprotected Sex Week, or we had AIDS Awareness, and then we have smoking and nutrition and so forth. In the lives of young people, this is all interrelated. It all kind of happens together. And I think it's important to try and talk about a lot of these things in some of the same conversations and over a long period of time, and not pretend that in the lives of young people, alcohol is totally separate from sex or drugs.
Have a Talk to Your Parents Week. Because I think what's missing a lot is a close quality relationship with the parent, so that the child, if they have a question about the ambiguity of the situation, can, you know, confer. The people they go to now are the peers, and there's more pressure to go towards the direction of sex or alcohol.
Well, thanks very much for the call, Ed. Appreciate it. Let's move on to Ben, and Ben is on the line with us from St. Louis, Missouri.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Sure.
I'm a teenager, and I'm just a week shy of graduating from high school. But in my own personal experience, the only place in the public where sex education was available was, you know, in middle school, seventh grade, gym class. And in that, we went very in-depth about diseases, what they do, a liberal education as far as, yes, condoms were mentioned as prevention methods. But outside of the gym class and outside of individuals with their parents, kids weren't really able to talk about it between ourselves in groups. If we were, you know, around the lunch table or something, a administrator would come by, say, stop talking about that. Or
really?
It's not encouraged. It's more suppressed because it's a mum topic. It's about sex.
Well, one of the heartening movements nationwide that I think is relevant to what you just said is the great interest in peer counselors in schools. Because as much as all of us want parents to be askable parents and to be cozy, you know, cozy fellows that that their teenagers communicate with easily, that's not always the case. And a lot of schools in recent years have developed programs of peer counselors where young people are trained on sort of the basics so that they can talk at the lunch table and they can talk in the hallways with their fellow students about some of these important issues. And the very good peer counselors are particularly trained to enlist the help of adults if there's a really serious problem. You know, if they learn about a real problem, not to pretend that a 15-year-old or 16-year-old can take it on. So maybe we need some peer counselors in your school.
Ben, can you stay with us? We're going to take a break. I wanted to come back and continue our conversation.
Sure thing.
Okay, I'm going to put you on hold just for a second. We're talking about a new report about young teenagers and sex, and we'll come back and take more of your calls. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. Our guest is Sarah Brown of the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy. Back after the break. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we'll turn our conversation to the final episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. That's scheduled for tonight, and we'll talk about the role of Buffy in popular culture. But right now, we're discussing a new report on young teens and sex. It's called 14 and Younger, The Sexual Behavior of Young Adolescents. It was released today by the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy. Sarah Brown directs that organization. She's with us here in Studio 3A. If you'd like to join our conversation, the number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN at NPR.org. And Ben is with us on the line from St. Louis, Missouri, just about to graduate from high school. Is that right, Ben?
Yeah, in about a week.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I did want to ask you, though, about you were talking about the paucity of sex education in your school system, at least. What was, you think back to middle school, was there a lot of sexual behavior going on?
As far as I knew, no, but I wasn't the most popular, so.
I wasn't either. That's okay.
And I guess what I could say from that is I think more of the, I shouldn't say the more the popular kids are doing it, because from what I know now, everybody, it doesn't matter what group, there's probably somebody sexually active mm-hmm. within the group. But evidently that's where it was, and not trying to put myself down, but I had book friends.
Yeah, me too, Ben.
Yeah.
Appreciate the phone call. Thanks very much.
All right, thanks. Bye.
All right. And Ben raises an issue of, well, I guess it has to be discussed. Your findings reveal that the double standard arises very early.
You know, I began working in this field about 30 years ago, and then I took a sort of a detour. When I came back to the issue of teen pregnancy 7 or 8 years ago, I thought maybe things had changed a little bit, and of course they certainly have. For example, AIDS has erupted on the scene. But the notion that, for example, having sex might make a boy more popular is still alive and well. There are some gender differences here, although we have to be careful. For example, young boys also report that they are sometimes under pressure to be sexually active, whereas I think in an earlier time we thought it was only young girls who were under pressure. I think the fact is that young people are under pressure in a variety of ways about sex. They think about it. They have a lot of information coming at them, a lot of images from the media, a lot of talk. And trying to sort of sort all that out and figure out what your own course through adolescence is going to be is really tough right now. Mm-hmm. So, you know, parents and school counselors and all, we really need to understand that even at 12 or 13, a lot of these topics that we thought were for 17-year-olds are now very much in the lives of these young people.
We need to talk about methodology just for a moment. This is, for example, not new data for the most part, a reexamination of earlier studies. Explain that for us.
This report includes three principal papers, which are from nationally representative data sets that were compiled in the mid to later 1990s. They have been around for a while, but they hadn't been looked at quite as specifically as we have about the proportion you've had sex and pregnant and contraceptive use and so forth. And then we included some analyses from some smaller area data sets. I wish we had more current information on the proportion of young teens who've had sex, but this information we're putting out today from the mid to later 90s is the most recent. Mm-hmm. And people say to me sometimes, well, why is that? Why? I mean, this is important stuff. Why don't we know more today about very young teens? Well, there's a fairly simple reason, which is that parents and funders, including public funders, are very squeamish about asking very young teens about their sexual practices, to say nothing of, you know, including their attitudes. For example, if you say, hey, I have an idea, let's ask a whole bunch of 12-year-olds about whether they've had sex or not, or even questions about oral sex, which is a very hot topic. Researchers may want to know. Public health practitioners may want to know. Professional educators may want to know. Parents say, don't you dare ask my 12-year-old daughter about that. And the funders, of course, may also want to know, but they don't want a court controversy. So one of the things that's going on here is that we sort of want to know. I mean, I'm impressed by how many people are interested in this report from data from the mid to later 1990s. We want to know, but we are concerned and nervous and uncomfortable about asking very sensitive questions to very young people. That's why we don't know more.
Let's get back to the callers. Our next caller is Liz, who's on the line from Los Angeles.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a 35-year-old woman. I graduated from high school in 1986. I grew up in a upper middle class family in Westchester, New York. Mm-hmm. And we all had sex from starting around eighth grade and into freshman year of high school.
So that would be at the later part of this, when you were 14, basically.
Yeah, 14. For me, it was 14. For most of my friends, it was 13, 14. And the big common denominator for us, which is, that was the fact that our parents were not around. That, you know, we all went through divorce around sixth, seventh, and eighth grade. And one of the things that's so appealing about sex when you're an adolescent is that it creates this kind of faux feeling of family, of belonging, of making, you know, it takes it to that heightened level of feeling like you mattered. And, you know, as a 35-year-old now mom, though my child is much younger, it's something that my friends and I all talk about a lot, about how to combat that. Now, I was really lucky because when my mother found out that I was having sex, she was very upset, and so was my father. But they also said, okay, listen, you know, we don't agree with this choice. We want you to stop right now. But if you are not going to, we want to take you to the gynecologist. And we want you to have birth control. And as a result of that, I was the only one, and I was also in the popular crowd, we were athletes, scholars, that did not get pregnant. Out of a group of about 12 girls, I would say more than two-thirds of them ended up getting pregnant junior and senior year, and all had abortions. And I did not. And that was because my parents, though they were horrified to hear what I was doing, took care of me.
Sarah Brown?
Well, there are two things that you raise that I'd like to kind of underscore. The first is the simple issue of useful, supervised things to do. You know, it sounds so old-fashioned, but if young people are left alone for hours and hours and hours, just kind of on the lam, in the malls, AWOL, we should not be surprised, particularly in this cultural environment, that life is going to happen. Sex is going to happen, drugs may happen, and so forth. So one of the first things we tell parents is that, you know, the kids need useful places to go where there are adults around, engage in interesting things that give them something to say yes to, give them things that are more engaging and enticing than early sex and pregnancy. So some of these old-fashioned ideas of useful things to do and not copious amounts of idle time is very important. It sounds so old-fashioned, so boring, but there's a lot of data to back that up, and of course your story is very compelling. Yeah. With regard to contraception, you're absolutely right. When people are sexually active, there are some who may be encouraged to stop. Parents will often tell their children, I understand what you're doing, I don't agree with it, I want you to stop, or programs will encourage them to stop, and some will, no question about it. But many won't, or at least some won't. And for young people who are having sex, the only way that they are going to avoid pregnancy and STDs is if they use contraception and protection. We can't ignore that. We can ask young people to stop, a 14-year-old, a 13-year-old, but if they are going to be sexually active, you know, we can't lock them in their rooms, or at least I sure hope we aren't, then we have to deal with the reality of what they're doing.
Liz, I don't know how old your kids are now.
I'm pregnant, and one's 16 months.
Well, in other words, you're not on the edge of having the talk.
No, I'm not. But, you know, I have plenty of friends, you know, who are on the, you know, who have 12 and 13-year-olds. And having gone through that experience, it's something that I will absolutely do with my children. And, you know, just to follow up on what she just said, is that I did stop having sex. I had my boyfriend and my parents freaked out, and they said, if you're going to do this, I want you to use birth control. We don't want you to do this. And, you know, having them so involved, I got the birth control, I continued having sex with my boyfriend. When we broke up, rather than continuing in sexual relationships with other people, I stopped and did not have sex I know it doesn't sound that noble to have stopped until, I made a vow to myself, I will not have sex again until I am at least 17. And that's, I waited a long time. I waited until I was almost 18. And then, you know, again, with my mother's blessing, who then took me again to the gynecologist. You know, but this time she felt much better about it because I was an older child.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, still no one wants their 18-year-old to have sex.
No.
But at least, you know, I can't tell you how important it was to have my parents' involvement. And also what was said also about just not having not having supervised time. And it's not even about having supervised time. It's about having your parents pay attention, having your parents acknowledge you and talk to you and be there for you. It does sound old-fashioned. It sounds like, you know, here I'm this lefty liberal, and, you know, it sounds like family value talk, but it's the truth. Parents matter. What they do and what they say matter.
Liz, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
One of the things that she raises is also comes up in your study, and that is the idea that once kids do start having sex, it's not like necessarily they're having sex every day or every week, or it can be very sporadic.
Exactly. I appreciated, Liz, your telling us about that. It is true. There's some young people who have sex once or twice as a young person don't for a number of years. It's not as though once you have sex, it's like the floodgates are open. I also want to underscore another issue you raised, which is this notion of the talk. What we really are finding in research is that these other things like closeness between parents and children over many years, that makes much more difference than this 45-minute awkward talk at the kitchen table. Communication is good about sex. We need to do more of it. But it is no substitute for parents and their children being very close and being deeply engaged in their lives. That is as protective, more so than any particular talk.
Mm-hmm. Well, here's a question exactly on that point from Robbie Heckman on email. With the early age of initial sexual activity, how and when should parents begin the dialogue? What is enough and too much information for children under 10 years old?
Well, obviously, there are issues that are developmentally appropriate at different ages. You know, I don't think we need to talk to a 10-year-old about all the ins and outs of particular contraceptive methods necessarily. So the point, though, is that from a very early age, way before 10, families can and should be talking about relationships. What is a respectful relationship between boys and girls? If someone grabs you on the playground, you don't like it. What do you think about that? What are you going to do? How do we say things to people that maybe might hurt their feelings, but we think it's the right thing to do? Those issues are timeless, in a sense. They're important to talk with young people about. And as they get older, we talk more and more about particular issues of sex and pregnancy and contraception and all the other issues that are out there in the lives of young people. So it's really an 18-year conversation. And when little kids are little, we talk about little simple things. And when they get older and their lives are more complicated, we have to talk about the more complicated things. And one of the biggest helps we have in this is the media. All you have to do is watch TV with young people, and you will have more fodder to start a conversation than you ever thought you needed.
Our guest is Sarah Brown, the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy. In the headlines today from NPR News, the nation's terrorism alert level has again been raised to orange or high. The change follows reports from the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security based in part on foreign intelligence. Also, the Bush administration is stepping up a push to change the way national forest land is controlled and managed. Efforts to speed the thinning of timber in fire-prone areas have drawn sharp criticism from environmentalists. You can hear reports on those stories later today from NPR's Pam Fessler and Don Gagne on All Things Considered from NPR News. And right now you're listening to Talk of the Nation, also from NPR News. And let's go now to Bess. And Bess is on the line with us from Des Moines, Iowa.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I am a mother of three daughters, 14, 13, and 11, and recently, this last school year, my daughter's a freshman in high school, a boy broke up with her because she would not have oral sex with him, and she feels, we've talked about that, and I've told her that oral sex is sex, and that it's, you know, that's how she should view it, and this boy vehemently disagreed with her, and they had many discussions that she shared with me about that subject. And I just wondered what your survey found out about how young kids think about oral sex.
Well, first of all, congratulations for being a mother that your daughter would talk to so openly about something that sensitive. It must mean you're very good at this and well connected. May I ask you one question?
Sure.
How old was your daughter's boyfriend?
Her same age.
Same age.
Which is, thank God, because my daughter is quite mature looking, and I've always been afraid that she would attract older boys.
Well, and of course, that does happen a lot. One of the findings of this report we're releasing today suggests that early one-on-one dating, which may have been the case in your family, does often put these kids into difficult situations. You described one.
Yes,
so one of the tips to parents, for example, is to the extent you can, to try and encourage group activities and not to sort of one-on-one romantic things. I mean, I don't understand, for example, why a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old should have or needs to have a real boyfriend. I think group activities are fine. So that's...
This was her first boyfriend.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's quite outgoing, and I felt lucky that it held off this long, actually, because she's always gotten a lot of attention.
But Bess specifically asked about statistics on oral sex. You were not able to obtain them. The study didn't cover them because of the sensitivity you mentioned
earlier.
We also have an email, excuse me, Bess, just a moment, from Bill McHenry in Stowe, Ohio, asking about gay sex, and I would assume that would fall under the same category.
I wish we did know more about gay sex, oral sex, anal sex, because we are asked a lot about that. But again, the willingness of researchers and parents and funders to ask very young children, really, about these questions is limited, so we know much, much less. We do know that a number of young people are having oral sex. We do know, for example, that it carries risks. You can get sexually transmitted diseases from it. So congratulations to your daughter for saying no. I have three daughters, too, and I mean that's just not necessary, and it's out of bounds.
Bess, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Let's get one final call in on this subject. Carolyn joins us from San Francisco.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I am the grandmother of a 14-year-old girl. We live in different states and visit during the year. I have two questions, two parts. One is fairly straightforward, and in listening to this, I was wondering what you would think about buying a tape later and having her listen. we do know that she's experimenting much more than we think she should be. We don't know the extent. So that's one possibility, and I want to know what you thought about that. Then I have another part.
Well, we may only have time for one question, Carolyn, because we're almost
out of time. My question, let me give the second part quickly.
Very quickly.
Is basically, how can I help? I'm the grandmother without interfering. The parents are not particularly tuned into this. How can I be of any help?
Okay.
Well, it sounds to me like you may be one of the key adults in the life of this young girl, and I think anything you can do to get good information to her and to clue her parents in to what may be going on in her life will help. So, you know, this report, for example, can be downloaded off of our website, a simple summary that the parents might find engaging. I don't know if you want to send a tape to her. That may work. The point, though, is to talk with her extensively about these issues, to not pretend they don't exist, which clearly you don't, and to try and bring some openness and reality to her. Even so, it may not work out. You know, there are no guarantees in life, but I congratulate you for wanting to try.
And if you think a tape or transcript of this program might be helpful, you can get information on that at www.npr.org. Sarah Brown, thanks so much for being with us today. We appreciate it. Sarah Brown is director of the National Campaign to Prevent Teenage Pregnancy. She was with us here in Studio 3A. When we come back, it's the last stand for Buffy the Vampire Slayer as she battles the ferocious First. What's the influence of Buffy on popular culture? 800-989-8255 or TOTN at npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.